these barriers with collisions and groundings in mind. None had imagined that a torpedo might one day be detonated against the hull from underwater. Just inside the hull, at the point of impact, stood the starboard end of a major watertight bulkhead that spanned the width of the hull, one of a dozen such dividers in the ship. This particular bulkhead also formed a wall between the forwardmost boiler room number one, and a large coal storage chamber just beyond toward the bow, called the cross bunker, the only coal bunker in the ship arrayed across the full width of the hull. The rest were the longitudinal bunkers that ran along the hull walls. At this point in the voyage, all the bunkers were nearly empty. The forward motion of the ship, initially 18 knots, caused forced flooding, which drove seawater into the ship at a rate estimated at 100 tons a second. Water surged into the cross bunker and into boiler room number one, a cavern that housed two one-ended boilers and two double boilers, and the beginning of a main steam line. Water also flowed into the longitudinal bunkers along the starboard side, nearest the impact zone. As these bunkers filled with water, the ship began to list to starboard. At the same time, the water filling boiler room number one and the forward cross bunker caused the bow to begin sinking. The stern began to rise, and the hull to twist. Captain Turner was standing on A deck, just outside the entry to his rooms, when he heard the lookout's cry that a torpedo was coming. He saw the track and watched it pass below the starboard rail. There was a brief silence, and then a column of water and wreckage erupted from the sea. The shock of the explosion and the sudden list to starboard threw Turner off balance. With debris and seawater falling behind him, Turner ran up the stairway to the bridge. How passengers experienced the blast depended on where they were situated when it happened. The ship was so long, nearly 800 feet, and so elastic that those standing or seated toward the stern, in the second-class smoking and dining rooms and the veranda café, or on the stern counter where the deck swept out over the rudder, felt it as a dull thud. Oliver Bernard recalled thinking, well, that wasn't so bad. Those closest to the bridge felt the impact in a manner more vivid and tactile. Water, bits of coal, splinters of wood, etc., coming down on our heads, recalled Dwight Harris. I flattened up against the side of the ship, but got soaked. Preston Pritchard and Grace French were happily searching for her double when they heard the explosion and felt the ship lurch to starboard. The ship listed so much that we all scrambled down the deck, and for a moment everything was in confusion, she recalled. When I came to myself again, I glanced around but could find no trace of Mr. Pritchard. He seemed to have disappeared. Too frightened to go to her own cabin, Miss French set off to look for a life jacket on deck, apparently unaware that all jackets were stored in passengers' rooms. Out came the watches. William McMillan Adams, 19 years old and always handy with a timepiece, put the moment of impact at 2:05. I timed everything, he said later. When asked why, he replied, I just did it. I don't know why. Charles Laureate checked his stem-winding wristwatch and pegged the impact at 9:08 a.m. Boston time or 2:08 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Others put the time at 2:10. This would later become the agreed-upon benchmark. Within seconds, Laureate felt the ship roll to the right and tilt toward the bow. You could feel the two separate motions very distinctly, Laureate wrote. It seemed as if she were going down at once, but then she stopped suddenly, as if the sea had met the watertight bulkheads, and she seemed to right herself and even raise her bow a little. This gave me a feeling of security, and I at first thought she would stay afloat. Moments later, a second explosion occurred. The ever-precise William McMillan Adams timed this at 30 seconds after the first. Its character was different. Where the first had been a single, sharp detonation, this one, Laureate said, was very muffled. A shudder traveled the length of the ship and seemed to rise from deep within the hull. "More like an explosion of a boiler, I should think," said Laureate. He was unable to identify the location with any precision. The sound was not distinct enough, he said. In the dining rooms, the plants set out on tables shifted. Glassware fell to the floor. Margaret Mackworth and her father, D.A. Thomas, having finished lunch, were about to enter the elevator on D-deck, when Thomas joked, "I think we might stay up on deck tonight to see if we get our thrill." Before Mackworth could answer, she heard a dull explosion, not loud, more a heavy thud that rose from somewhere below. I turned and came out of the lift. Somehow the stairs seemed safer. Her father set off to try to learn more about what had happened. Mackworth, in accord with her earlier plan, went straight to her room on B deck to get her life jacket. The degree of list made progress difficult. She moved along the lower side of the passage in the angle between wall and floor and collided with an oncoming stewardess. The two, Mackworth wrote, wasted a minute or so making polite apologies to each other. After retrieving her life jacket, Mackworth ran to her father's cabin and got one for him as well. She climbed to the open boat deck and moved to the higher side, the port side, judging it safer to be as far away from the submarine as possible. There she encountered her table mate, Dorothy Connor, and asked if she could stand with her while she waited for her father. She put on her life jacket. A crowd of third-class passengers emerged from below, with great energy and noise. Mackworth turned to Connor and said, "I always thought a shipwreck was a well-organized affair." "So did I," Connor replied, "but I've learnt a devil of a lot in the last 5 minutes." Charles Laureate was standing next to Elbert Hubbard and his wife. He urged them to go to their room and get their life jackets, but the couple seemed paralyzed. Mr. Hubbard stayed by the rail, affectionately holding his arm around his wife's waist, and both seemed unable to act. Laureate told Hubbard, "If you don't care to come, stay here and I will get them for you." Laureate set off for his own quarters. For the many parents aboard, the blast brought a unique sort of terror. The Cromptons of Philadelphia had 6 children scattered over the ship. The Pearl family of New York had 4. The ship was immense, and older children had the run of its decks. Parents were compelled to hunt for their children among the ever-growing crowds of passengers swarming the boat deck, while at the same time holding babies and corralling toddlers. Nora Bretherton, the 32-year-old wife of a journalist in Los Angeles, had booked passage aboard the Lusitania so that she could bring her 2 children, Paul and Elizabeth, to meet her parents in England. Paul was 3 years old. Elizabeth, Betty, was 1.5. Bretherton, pregnant, was traveling alone with the children because her husband had to stay behind in California to work. Her cabin was a second-class room toward the stern of C deck, the shelter deck. Before lunch, she had dropped her daughter off at a play yard on the deck above, then placed her son in the cabin for a nap and left him there. When the torpedo struck, she was in a stairwell between the 2 decks. She froze. She had no idea where to go first. Up 1 deck to retrieve her baby girl, or down a deck to get her napping son. All lamps went out. The sudden list of the ship threw her from one side of the stairwell to the other. She ran for the baby. On entering the bridge, Captain Turner began issuing commands. He ordered the engines full astern. The reverse turbines were the ship's brakes, the only way to bring it to a stop, and the ship had to be stopped before any lifeboats could be launched with safety. The engines did not respond. Turner told the helmsman, Quartermaster Hugh Johnston, to turn the ship hard toward the coast, still a dozen miles off. If worst came to worst, he would beach the ship and at least eliminate the danger of sinking. Johnston stood inside the wheelhouse, a small enclosure within the bridge. He repeated Turner's command to confirm that he understood. He rotated the wheel to produce what should have been a 35-degree turn toward shore. All right, boy, Turner said. The ship responded, according to Johnston. Captain Turner now ordered him to steady the ship, that is, to adjust the wheel to counter the tendency to continue turning once the desired heading was achieved. Johnston gave the ship 35 degrees helm in the opposite direction. Keep her ahead on Kinsale, Turner said, directing Johnston to aim the bow toward the lighthouse on the old head. Johnston echoed the order and began its execution. This time, the helm failed to answer. The ship began to veer, to pay off toward open sea. Johnston attempted to counter the drift. I was doing all I was supposed to do, steadying the ship, Johnston said, but she was swinging off again. Turner repeated his order for a turn toward shore. Johnston tried. I put the wheel round, but she would not answer her helm, but kept on swinging out toward the sea. Turner told Second Officer Percy Hefford to check the ship's spirit indicator, a marine version of a carpenter's level, to gauge the severity of the list. Hefford called out, 15 degrees to starboard, sir. Turner gave the order to close the ship's watertight doors below the passenger decks, which were operated with a control along the front wall of the bridge. To make sure the doors really did close, Turner told Hefford to go down into the forecastle and check. Hefford stopped at the wheelhouse and told Johnston to keep his eye on the spirit indicator and sing out if she goes any further. Hefford left the bridge. He did not reappear. Turner ordered the lifeboats lowered to the rails, that is, to a level where they could be safely boarded by passengers. The boats still could not be launched, however, for sheer momentum continued to propel the Lusitania forward, initially at 18 knots. Had the reverse turbines responded, the ship could have been stopped in under 3 minutes, but now only the drag of the sea could bring it to a halt. The liner moved in a long arc away from shore. The forced flooding continued. At the wheel, Johnston checked the spirit gauge. The list held steady at 15 degrees. Turner stepped out onto the bridge wing. Below him, the boat deck was filling with passengers and deckhands. Firemen black with soot worked their way through the crowd like shadows. Some of them climbed out of the ship's vents. Down in quarantine, Robert Kay and his mother felt the torpedo blast, which Robert described as a violent explosion. This was followed by a second, more muted eruption that seemed to come from within the ship. The lights went out. His mother was tense, but oddly calm, Robert recalled, though she expressed concern that in her condition, so deeply pregnant, they might never reach the upper decks safely. The door to quarantine was no longer plumb in its frame. They forced it open. The corridor outside was dark, tilted both to starboard and toward the bow. They moved slowly. Robert tried to help, but every step was an effort, and our progress was painfully slow, he wrote. The combined starboard and forward list made stairways dangerous. The Ks held tight to handrails, but with each moment it seemed that the surroundings became more and more crazily distorted. Everyone else seemed to have gone. There was quiet, though now and then Robert heard a shout from far above. With great effort, he and his mother worked their way upward. 5 minutes had elapsed since the initial explosion. Charles Laureate returned to deck, carrying all the life jackets he could. He put his on first, then helped others. These were the new body life jackets. If worn properly, they were effective in keeping even an oversized man afloat, comfortably on his back, But Laureate saw that nearly everyone around him had put the jackets on incorrectly. Cunard had not yet established a policy of having passengers try on life jackets at the start of a voyage. The only guide was an illustrated instruction sheet posted in each room, in the apparent belief that passengers would have the time and presence of mind to read and follow it. The fault in this logic now became evident. In their hurry, they put them on every way except the right way, Laureate wrote. One man had his arm through one armhole and his head through the other. Others had them on around the waist and upside down, but very few had them on correctly. Laureate was standing within earshot of the bridge when he heard a woman call out to Captain Turner, her voice steady and calm. "Captain, what do you wish us to do?" "Stay right where you are, madam. She's all right." "Where do you get your information?" she asked. "From the engine room, madam," he said. But the engine room clearly had told him no such thing. Apparently he was seeking to calm the crowd below and avoid setting off a panicked race for the boats. This was the last Laureate saw of Turner. Laureate and the woman now headed back toward the stern, and as they walked, they told other passengers what the captain had said. Second-class passenger Henry Needham may have encountered the pair, for he recalled that a passenger approaching from the direction of the bridge had shouted, "The captain says the boat will not sink." The remark, Needham wrote, was greeted with cheers, and I noticed many people who had been endeavoring to get a place in the boats turn away in apparent contentment. Turner's words merely confirmed what the passengers and many of the crew already believed, or wanted to believe, that no torpedo could cause the ship mortal damage. The ship's purser and surgeon spent the moments after the two explosions calmly strolling along the boat deck, smoking cigarettes, assuring passengers the ship was not in any danger. And this seemed entirely plausible. The Lusitania was simply too big and too well built to sink. What made the idea even more incongruous was the setting. A gleaming May afternoon, warm and still, the sea smooth and the headlands of Ireland visible in the distance, so green they seemed to luminesce in the sunshine. Isaac Lehman, the New York businessman, did not share this confidence in the ship's unsinkability. He went to his stateroom to get his life jacket and found that someone had entered his room and taken it. A nervous man, Lehman feared chaos. "I don't know what possessed me," he said. "But I looked in my dress suitcase and got hold of my revolver, as I figured this would come in handy in case there was anybody not doing the proper thing." There were shipbuilders among the Lusitania's passengers, and at first they too believed the ship would remain afloat. One of them, Frederick J. Gauntlet, an executive with the Newport News Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company, was on his way to Europe to meet with builders of submarines with an eye to starting a venture in the United States. He was traveling with the company's president, Albert Hopkins. Gauntlet was at lunch with Hopkins and another shipbuilder, a Philadelphian named Samuel Knox. It was Knox's company that had built the Gulflight, the American oil tanker torpedoed a week earlier. They sat at their usual table, the sixth one back on the starboard side. They wore suits. The tablecloths were white, and each table had clear glass vases with cut flowers. Sunlight streamed through the windows. The room tilted to the right. A vase fell from Gauntlet's table. "I left my coffee and nuts," he said, and rose from the table and shouted to the stewards to close the ports. As a shipbuilder, he understood the danger posed by open portholes. He shouted half a dozen times. The stewards evidently had business elsewhere, he said, and when they left the dining saloon, I followed suit and left the dining room also. He and his lunchmates did not themselves attempt to close the ports, and these remained open. Gauntlet went to the coat rack, got his hat, and retrieved Knox's as well. They walked up 3 flights to the boat deck. Gauntlet was reassured that the list seemed to stabilize at 15 degrees. He was convinced the angle would not worsen, and never for one moment supposed she was going to sink. He said as much to a woman standing nearby, surrounded by her children. She asked him what to do. "I told her there was no danger," he said. "The ship was not going to sink." Gauntlet expected the bulkheads and watertight doors to keep the hull from flooding further. But then he sensed a change. The list became more pronounced, as did the tilt toward the bow, at which point he said, "I made up my mind that it was up to me to take a look around and see what the trouble was." He made his way to the railing at the forward end of the deck and looked over at the bow below. The forecastle was partially submerged. He went to his room and put on his life jacket. All the ship's systems were now dead. The rudder no longer operated. The main electric dynamo had failed. All lights were out. Anyone walking along an interior corridor now found himself in blackness. The operator in the Marconi room on the topmost deck switched to emergency power. The 2 first-class elevators at the center of the ship stalled. According to one account, passengers within began to scream. The elevator that provided the only access to the ship's baggage room also stopped. The scores of men working to get passengers' luggage ready for arrival either were dead from the torpedo blast or would be soon as water filled the bow. A fireman who escaped boiler room number 2, Eugene McDermott, described a rush of water that knocked me off my feet. Many of the dead crewmen were precisely those who would have been assigned to help launch the ship's lifeboats. Now, the sea found a new path into the hull. Water began to flow through open portholes, many of which were barely above the water to begin with. Those of E deck, for example, normally cleared the water by only 15 feet. By one estimate, at least 70 portholes had been left open in the starboard side. Multiplied by 3.75 tons of water per minute per porthole, that meant that 260 tons was entering the ship each minute through the starboard portholes alone. It was now about 2:20 p.m., 10 minutes since the torpedo struck. For the next few moments, as deckhands and passengers waited for the ship to slow enough to allow the safe launching of boats, there was quiet. "A strange silence prevailed," said Albert Bestick, junior third officer, "and small, insignificant sounds, such as the whimper of a child, the cry of a seagull, or the bang of a door, assumed alarming proportions." First word. The telegrams arrived at the Admiralty in London and the Naval Center in Queenstown in rapid and jarring sequence, sent from various points. 2:15, from Valentia Station to Queenstown. Lusitania in distress off Kinsale. Believed. 2:20, from Galley Head to Admiralty. Lusitania, southeast, 10 miles, sinking bow first, apparently attacked by submarine. 2:25, from Queenstown to Admiralty. Lusitania torpedoed, reported sinking 10 miles south of Kinsale. All available tugs and small craft being sent to her assistance. Aberdeen, Pembroke, Buncrana, Devonport, Liverpool informed. Lusitania. Decisions. The first attempts to launch the Lusitania's lifeboats revealed the true degree of danger now faced by the ship's passengers, and shattered the illusion of safety projected by having so many boats aboard. The list was so severe that the boats on the starboard side now hung well away from the hull, leaving a gap between the boats and the deck of 5 to 8 feet, with the sea 60 feet below. Members of the crew tried using deck chairs to span the opening, but most passengers chose to jump. Parents handed small children across. One boy took a running leap and landed in a boat feet first. Meanwhile, the lifeboats on the opposite side, the port side, had swung inward over the deck. These were all but unusable. Only a great effort could move them into position for launch. Captain Turner ordered them emptied, but as the ship's condition worsened, passengers and crew tried to launch them anyway. Ogden Hammond, the New Jersey real estate developer who'd been assured the ship was as safe as a New York trolley, walked along the port side of the boat deck with his wife Mary until they found themselves at boat number 20, which a group of crewmen and male passengers had somehow muscled to a point outside the rail. Women and children were climbing aboard. Neither Mary nor Ogden wore a life jacket. He had wanted to go down to their stateroom and retrieve the jacket stored there, but Mary had pleaded with him not to leave her. They had hunted for jackets on deck, but found none. At the lifeboat, Ogden balked at climbing aboard, out of respect for the maritime custom that gave women and children priority. Mary refused to go unless Ogden came too, so the couple stood aside, watching the process and waiting. At last Ogden agreed to get in. He and Mary took a place near the bow. The boat was half full, with about 35 people, when the attempt to launch it began. Men at the bow and stern manipulated the ropes, the falls, that ran through block and tackle at each end of the boat. A sailor at the bow lost control of his rope. Ogden tried to grab it, but the rope was running so fast it tore the skin from his hands. The bow plunged. The stern rope held. Everyone fell from the boat into the sea, 60 feet below. Ogden came to the surface. His wife did not. He reached for an oar floating nearby. At the next portside boat, number 18, another launching attempt had stalled. This boat contained 40 women and children and was held in place by a restraining pin. The sailor in charge refused to lower it, in accord with Turner's orders, but held an axe ready to knock the pin loose should the orders change. Several dozen passengers stood between the boat and the outer wall of the first-class smoking room. Isaac Lehman, the New York businessman, was shocked that no effort was being made to launch the boat. He had managed to find a life jacket. His revolver was in his pocket. He glanced toward the ship's bow and saw water advancing along the deck. He demanded to know why the sailor didn't act. "It is the captain's orders not to launch any boats," the sailor replied. "To hell with the captain," Lehman said. "Don't you see the boat is sinking?" He drew his revolver. "And the first man that disobeys my orders to launch the boat, I shoot to kill." The sailor complied. He swung his axe to knock out the restraining pin. The boat was heavy to begin with, but now loaded with 3 tons of humanity, it swung inward, crushing everyone between the boat and the wall. At least 2 passengers, sisters in their 50s, died instantly, of injuries associated with severe crushing. Lehman's right leg was damaged, but he managed to crawl from the mass of wounded bystanders. This was not easy. He was a large, round man and wore a long overcoat and a life jacket. Passengers and crew again attempted to launch the lifeboat. They were making progress when something went awry, and this boat, too, dumped its passengers into the water. At about the same time, Lehman said, a terrific explosion rose from the deck in the direction of the bow. This new convulsion was likely caused by water infiltrating yet another boiler room and coming in contact with a superheated tank, one of a number of such secondary eruptions. Only about 14 minutes had passed since the torpedo impact, but the sea was climbing fast. Many passengers decided to forego the boats and take a more direct path. Dwight Harris headed toward the bow as per his plan. He climbed over the port rail on A deck and scuttled down the side of the ship, two decks, then went toward the bow, which had sunk to the point where all he would have to do was step into the water. He took off his shoes and discarded his overcoat, his hat, and his Medici book. He had no life jacket, not even his custom Wanamaker's belt. He, too, had been afraid to go to his cabin for fear of being trapped. But now, at the water's edge and facing the real prospect of drowning, he changed his mind. I took a look at things and decided I must have a life belt, so I climbed up again to A deck and rushed to my cabin, he wrote. He put the belt on and returned to the bow. An officer called to him to come up to the lifeboats, but I realized that all available space in them was badly wanted, so I shook my head no. I got up on the rail, swung my feet over, and when the water got right up to the deck, I jumped overboard. As he swam away, he looked up and saw the ship's giant funnels move past against the sky. Theodate Pope and Edwin Friend had planned that if an emergency arose, they would rendezvous on the boat deck with Theodate's maid, Emily Robinson. The deck suddenly looked very strange, crowded with people, Theodate wrote, and I remember two women were crying in a pitifully weak way. Theodate and Friend looked over the port side and watched a boat being lowered. One end fell too fast and everyone plummeted into the sea. This could have been Ogden Hammond's boat, or the one layman tried to launch at gunpoint. We looked at each other, sickened by the sight, and then made our way through the crowd for Deck B on the starboard side. As they stood at the rail, they saw that efforts to launch the lifeboats on this side were having more success. Boats came down past them, winched slowly from the deck above. The two feared the ship was sinking so quickly and with so pronounced a list that it might roll onto the boats after they reached the water. They climbed back up to the boat deck, but made no attempt to board any of the remaining lifeboats. We walked close together, side by side, each with an arm around the other's waist, Theodate recalled. The two met a passenger whom by now they knew well, Marie Depage, the Belgian nurse. Depage seemed stunned. She had a man on either side of her, friends of hers, so I did not speak, Theodate wrote. It was no time for words, unless one could offer help. Theodate and Friend headed toward the stern, now an uphill climb. Her maid came up beside them, and Theodate noted the tense smile etched on her face. I could only put my hand on her shoulder and say, "Oh, Robinson." They searched for life jackets. They entered several cabins and found three. Friend helped the women put them on. They all walked to the rail. The ship's giant funnels towered above them at an exaggerated slant. The water was far below. Theodate glanced at Friend. The two looked down at the water. The time had come. I asked him to go first, she wrote. Friend climbed down one deck, then jumped. He disappeared briefly, but soon bobbed to the surface and looked up at the women. The ship continued to move forward. His form receded. Theodate said, "Come, Robinson," and stepped off the rail. Grace French ran back to where she and Preston Pritchard had been standing at the moment of impact. He was nowhere in sight. She went to the rail, took off her coat, and jumped. She had no life jacket. Her plan was to swim until she found a piece of floating debris. The jump took her deep under the surface, where an eddy caused by the passing ship held her down. By now, Captain Turner knew the ship would sink. He put on a life jacket but remained on the bridge, as did fellow officers and his helmsman, Hugh Johnston. In the Marconi house behind the bridge, the ship's chief wireless man, Robert Leith, used auxiliary power to send message after message, asking all ships in the vicinity to come at once. Turner asked Johnston for another readout of the spirit gauge. Johnston called, 25 degrees. Turner said, My God. His view from the bridge was of water surging over the forecastle below. He told Johnston, Save yourself. The time was about 2:25 p.m., 15 minutes since impact. Johnston left the bridge and found one of the ship's 35 life buoys. Water had reached the starboard bridge wing. Johnston entered the sea and was washed across the deck. I simply had to go wherever the tide took me, he said. Turner remained on the bridge. U-20, Schwieger's view. I took my position at the periscope again, Schwieger told his friend Max Valentiner. The ship was sinking with unbelievable rapidity. There was a terrific panic on her deck. Overcrowded lifeboats, fairly torn from their positions, dropped into the water. Desperate people ran helplessly up and down the decks. Men and women jumped into the water and tried to swim to empty, overturned lifeboats. It was the most terrible sight I have ever seen. It was impossible for me to give any help. I could have saved only a handful. And then the cruiser that had passed us was not very far away and must have picked up the distress signals. She would shortly appear, I thought. The scene was too horrible to watch, and I gave orders to dive to 20 meters and away. In his final log entry on the attack, at 2:25 p.m., Schwieger wrote, It would have been impossible for me anyhow to fire a second torpedo into this crushing crowd of humanity trying to save their lives. Schwieger directed his U-boat out to sea. His crew was jubilant. They had destroyed the Lusitania, the ship that symbolized British maritime prowess. Lusitania, the Little Army. Certain now that the ship would sink, Charles Laureate went back to his cabin at the forward end of B deck to rescue what he could of his belongings. As he moved along the corridor toward his room, he found vivid evidence of just how much the ship had listed. The floor was canted to a degree that made it impossible to walk without also stepping on the wall. The awkward bulk of his life jacket further impeded his progress. He passed open staterooms whose portholes had once provided views of sky and horizon, but now looked down onto water made dark by the shadow of the leaning hull. The only light in the corridor was a shifting silvery glow raised by sunlight glinting off the sea from beyond the ship's shadow. Laureate was startled to see that many of the portholes were open. His room was a black box. He found his matches and used these to locate his passport and other items he hoped to rescue. He grabbed his leather briefcase with the Dickens Christmas Carol inside, but left the Thackeray drawings in his shoe case. He hurried back onto the deck, which now was close to the water. A lifeboat containing women and children was floating just off his deck on the starboard side, but had not yet been released from the ropes that tied it to the davits on the boat deck above. This was boat number 7. Someone needed to act, and soon, Laureate realized, before the ship dragged the lifeboat under. He climbed into the boat and placed his briefcase on the bottom, then set about trying to free the stern. The bow remained tethered. Another man, a steward, was struggling to cut it loose with a pocket knife. The steamer was all the time rapidly settling, Laureate recalled, and to look at the tremendous smokestack hanging out over us only added to the terror of the people in the boat. Being this close to the hull brought home just how big the Lusitania truly was. Arthur Mitchell, the Raleigh bicycle agent who had wanted to hold lifeboat drills for passengers, was in boat number 15, 4 astern of Laureate's. He said, Never could one realize the size of the ship so well as at this moment, her great deck towering above us, and her enormous funnels clear against the sky, belching forth smoke which almost blinded the people in the boats around her. The ship was still moving, but sinking fast, the deck visibly descending. Laureate stood on a seat in the lifeboat, intending to go forward to help with the bow. The curved arm of a descending davit struck him from behind and knocked him down. He got up, this time mindful of the davit, and moved forward by stepping from seat to seat, forcing his way through the mass of passengers. The boat seemed to be full of oars, an infinite number, he wrote. He stepped on one. It rolled. He fell. By the time Laureate got to his feet, the now partially submerged forward davit was pressing on the bow of the lifeboat, and the boat's stern was rising. It was as though the ship had reached out with a clawed hand to drag the lifeboat down. There was nothing to be done. Laureate stepped from the boat into the water. He urged the other occupants to do likewise, but few did. The davit gripped the lifeboat and tipped it inward toward the deck, then pulled it under the water, with women and children, and the Dickens Carol still aboard. Shipbuilder Samuel Knox came across Paul Crompton, the Philadelphian traveling to England with his wife and six children. Crompton had corralled four of the children and was trying to put a life jacket on the youngest. A mere baby, Knox said. One of Crompton's older girls could not get her own jacket adjusted properly. With no apparent concern, she asked Knox, "Please, will you show me how to fix this?" Knox did so. The girl thanked him. Nora Bretherton, the Los Angeles woman who had run to rescue her infant daughter Betty while leaving her 3-year-old son asleep in her cabin, carried the baby up a stairway crammed with passengers. She forced the girl into the arms of a passing stranger, a man, then turned and went back down to get her son. The interior stairs were empty of people. She ran. Smoke came through the floors of the corridor and the cabin itself. She grabbed the boy, Paul, and carried him up to B-deck, to the starboard side, which by this point was canted so steeply that another woman, also holding a small boy, slid past along the deck on her back. Bretherton came to a lifeboat in process of being lowered. A male passenger told her she could not get in, that the boat was too full, but a friend of Bretherton's, already in the boat, persuaded the other passengers to allow her aboard. Bretherton had no idea where her baby was. On the way to the lifeboat, she had seen the man to whom she had given the child, but the man's arms were empty. Theodate Pope struggled to come to the surface, but found herself pressed against a barrier of some sort, something made of wood. She swallowed salt water. "I opened my eyes," she wrote, "and through the green water I could see what I was being dashed up against. It looked like the bottom and keel of one of the ship's boats." She was certain death was near, she wrote, "and committed myself to God's care in thought, a prayer without words." Then something struck her, and she lost consciousness. She awoke, floating on the surface, held up by her life jacket. For a few moments, everything she saw was gray. The limbs of frantic people jostled her. There was screaming and shouting. Color returned to her vision. A man, insane with fright, grabbed her around the shoulders. He had no life jacket. His bulk pushed her downward. "Oh, please don't," she said. Then she and the man sank below the surface. She passed out again. When she regained consciousness, the man was gone and she was afloat. There was sunshine and cerulean sky. The ship was well past and still moving. The men and women drifting in the sea around her were spaced more widely than before, and they were quieter. Some were alive, some clearly dead. Blood flowed from a gash in one man's forehead. An oar floated near. Her life jacket kept her buoyant, but even so she reached for the oar and draped her right foot over the blade. She raised her head to see if help was coming, but saw that none was. Then I sank back, very relieved in my mind, for I decided it was too horrible to be true, and that I was dreaming, and again lost consciousness. Elsewhere in the sea, a kindred soul also lay adrift. Mary Popham Lobb, a British citizen and spiritualist from the island of St. Vincent in the Caribbean. For her, this time in the water was mystical and moving. She found herself drifting farther and farther from the dense mass of bodies and wreckage left behind as the ship slid by. The cries of survivors became faint, as did the clatter of oars and the shouts of men in boats. She gave up all hope of rescue, and told herself the time to cross over had come. But another voice within told her no, this was not her moment. The gulls were flying overhead, she wrote, and I remember noticing the beauty of the blue shadows which the sea throws up to their white feathers. They were happy and alive, and made me feel rather lonely. My thoughts went to my people, looking forward to seeing me, and at that moment having tea in the garden. The idea of their grief was unbearable. I had to cry a little. Grace French, having jumped without a life jacket, sank deep into the sea. It got blacker and blacker until it became calm and peaceful, and I thought I must be in heaven, she wrote. The next thing I saw was the water getting lighter and lighter until I popped to the surface and grabbed hold of a plank of wood, and it helped keep me afloat. With that, I felt I was saved. I grabbed hold of a life jacket which had a dead young man in it. We floated together for a while until a big wave washed him away. Dwight Harris swam from the ship. I had no feeling of fear when I went overboard. He felt as comfortable as if he had simply entered a swimming pool, so composed that when he came across a floating book, he picked it up and examined it. The Lusitania moved past. I was carried by the whole length of the ship and saw everything that happened. The first lifeboat, starboard side, was in the water with only two sailors in it. They called to me to swim to it, but I kept on. The second boat was suspended and hanging straight down, the ropes at one end having jammed. The third and fourth boats were crowded with people. He saw that the sea was now level with the bridge. As the ship passed him, its stern rose into the air. For the family of Joseph Frankham of Birmingham, England, traveling with his wife, 3-year-old daughter, and 2 sons, ages 5 and 7, these last moments were terrifying. Frankham gathered them all in a lifeboat on the port side at the stern. The boat still hung from its davits, but Frankham hoped it would float free when the sea arrived. The view downhill was of chaos and death, punctuated with eruptions of black smoke as boilers exploded in succession. The mounting air pressure in the hull caused portholes to burst and seams and apertures to howl. But, strangely, there was also singing. First Tipperary, then Rule Britannia. Next came Abide With Me, but it was so moving and so sad that women began to cry, and the singers switched to Pull for the Shore, and then another round of Rule Britannia. Frankham said, I clung to my wife and children and held them tight. Margaret Mackworth stayed with the ship on the boat deck next to Dorothy Connor. Connor's brother-in-law was somewhere below looking for life jackets. A strange calm settled over the deck. People moved gently and vaguely, Mackworth recalled. They reminded one of a swarm of bees who do not know where the queen is gone. For a moment the ship seemed about to right itself. Word spread that the crew had at last been able to close its watertight bulkheads and that the danger of sinking was past. Mackworth and Connor shook hands. "Well, you've had your thrill, all right," Mackworth said. I never want another, Connor said. Connor's brother-in-law returned. He had been unable to reach his cabin because of water in the corridor, but had managed to find jackets elsewhere. The three put them on. Mackworth released the hook on her skirt to make it easier to take off later if the need arose. The ship's list returned, steeper than before. 17 minutes had elapsed since impact. They resolved to jump. The idea terrified Mackworth. She chided herself on this, telling myself how ridiculous I was to have physical fear of the jump when we stood in such grave danger as we did. Connor and her brother-in-law moved to the rail. Mackworth held back. Connor wrote, "One gets very close in 3 minutes at such a time, and just before we jumped, I grabbed her hand and squeezed to try and encourage her." But Mackworth stayed behind. Her last recollection was of water up to her knees and the ship sliding away, pulling her down. Theodore and Belle Nash, the Kansas City couple who just hours earlier had been admiring the sunrise from the ship's top deck, also stood at the rail. They wore life jackets and stood arm in arm, talking quietly. Having watched one lifeboat dump its occupants into the sea, they made no effort to get into another. A member of the crew told them, "She's all right. She will float for an hour." But Belle did not believe him. She'd been watching the rail and the horizon line. The changing differential told her the ship was sinking quickly. She said, "We'll be gone in a minute." She took her arm from Theodore's so as not to drag him under. We watched the water, talked to each other. There seemed to be a great rush, a roar and a splintering sound. Then the lifeboat or something swung over our heads. The boat struck her and cut her scalp. She held out an arm to protect Theodore. A sudden shift in the deck brought water to her armpits. It seemed as if everything in the universe ripped and tore. And then she was deep underwater. By her estimate, 20 or 30 feet. She looked up and saw the brilliant blue of the sky through the water. I thought about how wondrously beautiful the sunlight and water were from below the surface, she wrote. She was not afraid. I thought, why, this is like being in my grandmother's feather bed. I kicked and rose faster. Her head struck something and continued to bump against it. I put up my right hand, saw the blue sky, and found myself clinging to the bumper of Lifeboat 22. A man reached for her. She was so grateful she asked him to write his name on the inside of her shoe, lest in the experience to follow, I might forget. The name was Hertz, for Douglas Hertz, a young man who was returning to England to join the South Lancashire Regiment after living for a time in St. Louis. The sinking crowned a troubled period for Hertz. In 1913, he had lost his wife in a train wreck on their honeymoon. That same year, his mother had died in a house fire. Belle saw no sign of her husband. After helping to launch a starboard boat, number 13, seaman Leslie Morton went to help with a second, also on the starboard side. He and another sailor, under the direction of a petty officer, struggled to help passengers get across the gap between the ship and the boat. The final angle of list, by Morton's estimate, was 30 degrees. 60 passengers made it. Asked later how this feat had been achieved, Morton answered, "If you had to jump 6 or 7 feet, or certainly drown, it is surprising what a hell of a long way even older people can jump." Morton worked the stern falls as the petty officer directed the operation. The ship was still moving at 4 or 5 knots. The men lowered the lifeboat until its keel was just above the surface, and then, in accord with procedures for just this kind of circumstance, they let the lines play out so that when the boat touched water, it would slip backward. It drifted back one boat's length. The falls and the forward motion of the ship caused the boat to ride against the ship's hull. Morton was just about to climb down the stern ropes to clear the lifeboat when a group of less experienced men, Morton thought they might be stewards or waiters, began lowering the next boat back and lost control of its descent. The boat dropped 30 feet onto Morton's boat and the passengers within. There was no time to waste in either horror or sympathy, Morton wrote. He looked for his brother amid mounting confusion, many people losing their hold on the deck and slipping down and over the side, and a gradual crescendo of noise building up as the hundreds and hundreds of people began to realize that not only was she going down very fast, but in all probability too fast for them all to get away. He found his brother at another lifeboat and helped him to lower it. The brothers then slid down and released the falls and used boat hooks to try shoving the lifeboat away from the hull. The passengers wouldn't let go of the ship. They held tight to various ropes and to the deck rails, in some mistaken belief, Morton wrote, that they would be safer hanging on to the big ship rather than entrusting their lives in the small lifeboat. The Lusitania's deck came steadily downward. Something snagged the gunwale of the lifeboat and began tipping it toward the ship's hull. The time for heroics was obviously past, Morton wrote, and my brother yelled at the top of his voice, "I'm going over the side, Gertie!" The brothers waved at each other, then both dove into the sea. Neither wore a life jacket. Morton wrote, "As I hit the water, and it is strange what one thinks about in times of stress, I suddenly remembered that my brother had never been able to swim." Morton came to the surface and looked for his brother, but seeing the turmoil of bodies, women and children, deck chairs, life belts, life boats, and every describable thing around me, coupled with no less than 35,000 tons of Lusitania breathing very heavily down my neck and altogether too close for my liking, he began to swim. Hard. He glanced back. Two images became impressed in his memory. One was of a collapsible lifeboat slipping from the ship, still sheathed in its protective cover. The other, of Captain Turner in full dress uniform, still on the bridge, as the Lusitania began its final dive. Laureate swam clear of the ship. Or thought he had. He turned to watch its final moments. The bow was submerged and slipping deeper into the sea. The stern was high in the air. The list to starboard had become so pronounced that passengers could stand upright only by propping themselves against the starboard rail, where they accumulated 3 or 4 deep, in a long line that extended up toward the stern. Another witness called this assemblage a little army. If anyone still harbored a hope that the Lusitania would not sink, that hope now failed. Passengers back toward the stern, and therefore higher, watched as those ahead in line lost their grip on the rail. Those wearing life jackets floated, as if levitated from the deck. The many without jackets attempted to swim, or sank from view. Third Officer Bestick, still aboard, felt the ship make a peculiar lurching movement and looked down the deck. An all-swallowing wave, not unlike a surf comber on a beach, was rushing up the boat deck, enveloping passengers, boats, and everything that lay in its path, he wrote. A mass wail rose from those it engulfed. All the despair, terror, and anguish of hundreds of souls passing into eternity composed that awful cry. As measle-poxed Robert Kay and his pregnant mother struggled to ascend to the boat deck, the sounds of commotion above became more and more clear. They emerged to find themselves in a crush of people climbing toward the stern to escape the water ascending the deck. Robert watched people jump from the rails. The ship continued to move. Its stern rose higher. His mother held him close. And then the sea seemed to leap forward, and his mother was gone. They were separated. He was cast into a roiling turbulence. The ship disappeared. Later, a passenger reported seeing a woman giving birth.